On the Empire podcast this week, we talk to newly minted Best Actress Oscar winner Julianne Moore and ask her why she's so bloody great. And then we welcome husband-wife writing team Chappies Neil Blomkamp and Terry Tatchell into our pod booth and ask them why they're so chuffing adorable. All that and more hard-hitting movie journalism to come on the movie podcast that can't help but worry about the logistics involved if Bruce Banner and Natasha Romanoff have sex. I mean, what if he, and then...
Chris, here's a thought.
Mm-hmm.
What if the Hulk effect is a bit like steroids and it only makes some parts of your body bigger?
I was wondering about this, Helen.
Mm.
I was. You know, that would be a useful thing. I mean, then you could reverse it the other way. I've been thinking about this in too much detail today. Anyway, hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire podcast. This week, the two colleagues, that's the new format, in case you haven't twigged by now. This year, we're using just three people every week instead of four because of reasons.
It's been 3 years, and finally, we've got a new format. It's
a new format.
One fewer people.
and more grammar.
Yes.
Okay. The two colleagues, especially Ethel Cunning, you've just heard them, joining me for a good old cinematic chinwag on this World Book Day. We're recording this on World Book Day. Oh, who doesn't love books and worlds? I'm a huge fan of days, so these are my three favourite things all coming together. Our geek queen, Helen O'Hara, whose favourite book is... Apparently here, Helen.
Hello, yes.
101 things you can do with a Winchester. Is this true?
That isn't a book that exists yet, Chris. A favorite book is an impossible task. Today, I'll give my Lord of the Rings answer. It's an easy one.
Let's not go favourite book.
Okay.
Let's go, what are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? I am currently reading Chris Hadfield's book about being an astronaut.
Does he know you've got it?
Yes, he does, yes.
Okay, that's good.
Because it's signed to me. Thanks to our West Coast editor, James White.
No.
Yeah.
No way.
What a nice guy.
Wow.
Tell people who Chris Hadfield is in case you don't know.
He is an astronaut. He's the one who did the David Bowie song In Space, which I highly recommend watching on YouTube if you haven't seen it already.
Yes.
He's wonderful.
Yes,
he has an amazing moustache.
He's the Canadian guy who has a tash. Yes,
yes,
yes. Fantastic.
By the way, he's related to Benedict Cumberbatch very distantly. I once said that he was American by accident.
I wasn't going to mention that.
And the internet tore me apart. I am just chunks of meat and bone and a talking mouth getting grammar wrong.
And you are, of course, our film fact fiend, Mr. Ali Plum, whose favourite book... Is Ali, I don't know if this is right. Is the What a Fucking Idiot's Christmas Annual? Is this right?
Yeah, there are two coming out this year.
Both of them in June.
Both, yeah. Oh God, look at us! One of the favorite features in that is crosswords. There's puzzles. There's all sorts of song lyrics, of course. And there's a very, very good special on how to get your Chris Hewitt body in just 6 weeks. That's a guarantee. Ali, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading, and by this I mean I started reading this a bit ago and now it's a bit later, but in theory I'm still reading it.
The Bible.
The Bible. Is Ian Banks' Use of Weapons.
Amazing book.
Which is very good. I'm just not reading it as much as I should be.
Do you know I've never read an Ian M. Banks novel?
The M. Banks are better than the Banks. Really? There I said it.
The M is for good.
Really?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay. You know, Ian Rankin writes stuff.
Good point.
The Scottish author.
Okay.
I wonder if he should add an M to his name and write science fiction novels.
Science fiction crime novels.
Yeah, but with the same characters. I'm just about to start on, and you'll like this, Helen.
Yeah.
Because I can't say it, for one thing. The Abominable. Oh, I said it. Christ.
You did.
I did say it. I usually have problems with that. The Abominable by Dan Simmons.
Dan Simmons is a favourite of both of us.
He is. He's amazing.
I really enjoyed that one, and it made me feel not only like I wanted to climb Everest, but like I already had. Which is pretty good. I feel like I've been there and done that now because I read that book.
You kind of have because, you're awesome and you run marathons. You're running a marathon, aren't you?
I'm going to be running a marathon, yes. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here.
Is this up a mountain or where is this marathon?
It's Run London. So myself and Ollie Richards.
So it's a marathon in London.
There is a marathon in
London.
What's
it called?
It's called the London Marathon.
The London Marathon.
It's called Nike River Run.
Nike River Run.
I'm also doing a Nike run this year, but it's only 10K. But no, the marathon is on April 26th. Myself mm-hmm. and Ollie Richards, also of this parish, will be running on behalf of the NSPCC, which is a very good cause.
Mm-hmm.
My dad worked there for like 27 years, basically saving kids from bad people.
Uh-huh.
So it's one that's
like
close
Batman.
To my heart. essentially like Batman, except a bit cuddlier. Yeah.
Should we have some questions?
Let's do it.
We only have one this week. That's another change to the format. I don't know if you've noticed. We're really only doing one question. Three people, one question. It's the age of austerity, everybody. Here's a question from at Mikey P. London, who asks, listening to the Kingsman spoiler special made me think, oh, that's nice. What are the best directors who started as producers? And then he puts in brackets, M. Vaughn, Madame Vaughn. Matthew Vaughn, who, of course, was the producer of Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, Snatch, and Mean Machine. Best directors who started out as producers. Not that many.
Not that many, actually, no. I mean, in recent years, the only one that came to mind, apart from, obviously, Matthew Vaughn, was Frank Marshall, who's done some decent films. Mm-hmm. But probably is still best known, I think it's fair to say, as a producer. But stuff like Alive and was it Eight Dogs? What am I forgetting? Eight Below Zero?
Wild Dogs.
Well, he did do that film, didn't he?
Yeah,
with the one Paul Walker.
Yeah.
It's not called Eight Dogs.
It's called it's something called... not a million miles off that.
Some dogs.
A dog. Eight Below.
One fewer dog.
Eight Below.
Maybe.
And it is about dogs, and it's very nice, but it's probably not, you know, one of the all-time greats. But he did Arachnophobia as well.
He did do Arachnophobia, and Congo.
And Congo.
A lot of people have a lot of love for Congo.
Do they?
Genuinely, there was a thing this week. There was a thing this week where Den of Geek. They did a reappraisal of Congo. It was quite short, as I recall. But they did it. It was there. I saw Congo in the cinema. My main problem with Congo is that Bruce Campbell is in Congo. And at no point does he drink Mbongo. But also... He gets killed off, spoiler, far too early. He gets killed off before the credits roll.
I thought that the apes were, like, fantastically bad. Like, they were just, you know, it's as if, like, the neck gap between the top of the fake ape head and the rest of the suit would just be cocked and you'd see bits of skin and it was just a bit lame. And when they beat that guy to death in the cave, it's just... lame.
I don't remember that bit, but I do remember there's a bit where they're setting up camp by a river and someone starts singing California Dreamin' and then everybody joins in and then it turns into this thing where everybody's singing California Dreamin' and it's as bad as you might think. So that's my reappraisal of Congo. But Arachnophobia is fantastic.
Yeah. I think probably the right answer to this, with all respect to Matthew Vaughn, is probably Joseph L. Mankiewicz. You could argue whether he maybe started as a writer, but he was a producer for a while before he became a director.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed things like All About Eve, Guys and Dolls, Cleopatra,
Rubbish.
The original Quiet American, and the original Sleuth. I mean, that's a pretty good list.
It is a good list.
So, probably him, really.
It's not as good as Irwin Allen.
Well, Irwin Winkler... He's producer of things like Goodfellas, The Last of Us, Scorsese. He directed a number of films, including the Sandra Bullock movie, The Net. So I think he automatically leaps to the top of any list. But honestly, seriously, it's weird. Not that many people have done it. You think of the great, or at least certainly the most high-profile producers of the last 20, 30 years. So you're thinking of your Bruckheimers and your Joel Silvers and people like that. And very few of them... have shown any inclination to step in front of the behind of the camera. Behind of the camera.
Welcome to the Grandma Podcast, where things will be mispronounced and said.
You are welcome.
Maybe that's because it would be a step back for them in terms of power. Maybe this shows the limits of the auteur theory. The fact that more producers don't want to direct shows that they know that they're already at the top of the pyramid.
Maybe
I don't know.
Jerry Bruckheimer, I mean, has he not been directing a lot of his films for a while? I mean...
Well, and you could say they all bear a similar stamp in that many of them are terrible. But no, I don't... I'm only kidding, Jerry. Come back. No, I love Con Air. I love The Rock. I love one of the bad boys. It's all good. It's all good, Jer. Joel Silver's great. Yeah, I love him as well.
Phil the Sandman wanted me to mention something.
Did he?
there's a film called The Bad and the Beautiful, which deals directly with this issue by showing what happens when a Selznick-esque producer, Jonathan Shields, played by Kirk Douglas, starts directing for himself.
This is Vincente Minnelli.
So it's all about how he kind of is a bit crap when he actually comes down to, you know, saying action and making tension or humour or
anything tricky.
Like that.
It's a completely different skill set. But interesting enough, some people do transfer. I think Matthew Vaughn has transferred very, very nicely to the director's chair. But it is tricky. And also, I'm trying to think, there's a guy who produced Cloverfield a couple of years ago who...
Spielberg?
Matt Reeves.
Abrahams?
No.
Abrahams? J.F. Abrahams?
Something like that, yeah.
F.
Murray Abrahams, and he's had a go at directing. He's got something coming out this year, which is quite good, apparently. And then, of course, this guy Spielberg produced a number of films, and
didn't start off producing Spielberg, though, did he? I think he did some little-known indie stuff first.
Yes, he did. That's exactly it. But yeah, it's a tricky one. If you can think of anyone we haven't thought of, or anyone we haven't mentioned, or any glaring omissions. Or you want to just correct our grammar, by all means, do send in your questions or your corrections to our Twitter feed. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. We are also on Facebook, where you can poke us or just send us a message. And you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. Getting a lot of spam in that one recently.
Oh, no.
Time now for our first guest. Or should I say, guests. Guests, because there are two of them. Neil Blomkamp and Terry Tatchell are the husband slash wife writing team behind Blomkamp's directorial debut, District 9, for which they were both Oscar nominated. Now they're reteaming on this week's Chappie, about a South African police robot who's reprogrammed and may become sentient. Ooh. Blomkamp and Tatchell came in a couple of weeks ago to talk about their new movie, Terry's Restaurant in Vancouver, what their collective nickname is, and there's a couple of things in there about a little movie that Blomkamp's directing next is something to do with an alien. I'm not quite sure what that's about, but anyway. And they were talking to Nick Desemian and myself. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Neil Blomkamp and Terry Tatchell, co-writers of Chappie. Welcome. How are you guys?
Good, thanks.
Good. Excellent. Excited to be here.
Obviously, you worked together, you wrote together on District 9 as well as Chappie, but Terry, you said that initially you weren't going to be writing on Chappie, but you almost had a tie yourself the train tracks. You told Nick that very thing.
Actually, we weren't going to ever work together ever again is what it was. And then he woke up and told me it was amazing premise he had for a film that was pretty much fully formed on waking. And immediately I begged, please let me, I just loved it. I just fell in love with it immediately. And I think he said yes before he got to the bottom of the stairs.
It was like off to District 9. It was just a case of like wanting, you know, do you let work kind of come home? And not that, I mean, I never stop working. Like I literally don't have an off button.
All right.
So my off button should be like at home, then other people aren't accelerating, not having an off button. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be like, when I'm at home, it's like, let me just at least have 50% of my brain that isn't working.
He doesn't want to be woken up in the night.
She literally inundates me with stuff. Like,
that's true.
And that's what I didn't want. So I was like, we're going to put an end to working together. Yeah. You know, even though it's totally beneficial for me to work together, it's like, let's have a balance. Uh-huh. And it seems to have crept back now.
That what? The
working
craziness?
Together. No, the working. Oh. Like, we'll have to, like,
I didn't wake you up once in the night. No, not. Well, we have. Your next film, I'm not doing with him.
So. Okay.
Like, I don't have that thing, like, where a lot of artists refer to. I have incredibly vivid dreams and, like, very visual dreams, but they don't really ever drive, you know, film or story for me. It doesn't really work that way. I had one rad one once where I was in a Chinook helicopter that was like connected by some high tensile wire to a way bigger chopper, and all the windows in the Chinook were like covered in precipitation and like moisture, and I kept having to wipe it to see like thousands of other Chinooks hanging from bigger choppers. And I woke up and I was like, that shit is cool. I'm gonna put that in a film. And then it like went away.
I didn't ask to work on that one.
Yeah. That wasn't for her.
So there's a lot of military hardware in your dreams, didn't we?
Yeah.
Okay. That's rare. No, but that's rare. See, that's why maybe it stood out.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I wanted to ask about Hugh Jackman's character, Vincent, who is astonishing. I didn't kind of see it coming from the trailers, but he's a great character. He's kind of cool. David Brent meets Lord Humongous from Mad Max or something.
Yeah.
And the shorts are amazing. Yeah. Like, where did that guy come from?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember because, like, I have a terrible memory, but I think I know that by putting Dion Fuad in the film, there was this merging of fiction and reality in a way that I really liked because they were playing themselves. And I tried to do that in a few other places. Like, for instance, the weapons company that we filmed the movie in that is Tetraball. I went out of my way for 6 months to try to get, because we filmed it in a real South African state-owned weapons company, I tried to get the actual company, which would be similar to putting like Lockheed or something in a movie, and then it looks like you're advertising a weapons company, which is, you know, ethically a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
But the blurring of reality was very interesting to me. And so with Hugh, because my brain was working in that way, I wanted to make him Australian. So he wasn't, his accent wasn't synthetic. You know, I wanted to kind of use those inspirations to drive his character. But then because of like some sort of, you know, over the top nature that I think I have in fiction, I guess I just got pushed to the point that he had a mullet and like was an Australian farmer. Yeah. I remember the one thing I do remember, I remember telling Terry this, and like we were researching because he was religious, and obviously his point of view was, you know, to not do God's work and to not play with creating a new life form. He was going to not swear because of that. And so I wanted to research all of the, remember this, like with the researching, we researched like all these Australian slang, just really ridiculous terms without swearing that he could say. And like that was probably the, because I really don't like writing, but that was the only part of writing that was like hysterically funny, where I was writing shit like as cross as a frog in a sock and
that's
stuff.
That's the only one that made it in, isn't it?
Dunny Rat.
No, they're all in.
Dunny Rat stuck in my head.
No, they're literally all in.
Are they all in?
They're all in.
We had an Australian colleague who used to use soft cock as an insult. Yeah. And so we were hoping that would pop up.
That's a fantastic.
I might use that.
Let me go ahead and say that I didn't see that. One, but if I had seen that,
that would have been in for sure.
Yeah,
Softcoat would have been in there.
Yeah, we always used to say to him, "Why is that an insult? Why is it a bad thing? Why, do you want my?" If you follow that through to its logical conclusion, it takes you to some very dark areas. But I was at Comic-Con a few years ago when you were doing the press conference there for Elysium, and I seem to remember this. I may be wrong, but I seem to remember you describing Chappie at the time as a family comedy. Now. It seems like a very twisted family comedy, family comedy. Is that something that you were thinking about as it came about?
My recollection of that, which is going to be not as good as yours, because like I've established my memory doesn't really work. Terry can attest to this.
It's convenient, actually.
Yeah, more of a convenient memory. I remember talking about another project, which is a comedy that I wanted to make around the time that I was marketing Elysium, and also talking about Chappie. And I felt like the wires got like crossed a little bit.
They may have been conflated.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of people have said, you said Chappie was a comedy. And I'm like, no, I said another film was a comedy.
No, you did, actually. I was at that press conference standing in the back, and you actually did say Chappie was a comedy.
Well, then you're both right.
It's on
tape.
It's the family part that I don't recall.
Okay, let's go ahead and...
It's a comedy with a family in it.
It's
funny. It's a funny movie, though. Yeah. All your movies are funny. Mm-hmm. So,
well, Elysium isn't really like rolling in the aisles like style.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
When he hides under the pigs, it's funny.
Yeah.
But Kruger is a hilarious character.
Yeah, I love
Kruger.
He's the
humor.
When he sings, I love
him. No, Kruger is awesome.
And I talked to you on the phone not too long ago. You mentioned there was a Kruger spin-off idea in the back of your head.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, it's like, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about how film has to conform to a lot of... There's a lot of, like, three-act structure kind of specificity about how movies have to get made. And sometimes I just don't want that. Sometimes I want the Grand Theft Auto, like, experience of just, like, anarchic horseshit, you know, and Kruger can get up to that. So I actually did ask Modi, who paid for Elysium, I was like, what if you did, like, a lower-budget version of this where Kruger is the lead character and there's, like, absolutely no arc? Don't expect the character to arc. He just does a bunch of shit that's awesome. And he was like, yeah, that does sound like that could be cool.
In case people haven't guessed, you are married, husband and wife. We were discussing this earlier on. You're the Brangelina of the scriptwriting world. Do you have a name, a Brangelina style name? Is it Tat Camp or Blomchill? Or
which one do you guys prefer?
Blomchill.
Yeah. Blomchill.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that? Clearly you haven't from your reaction.
I do, yeah. Blomchill is probably
Blomchill
the way
works.
To go there.
Blomchill?
Yeah.
I liked Tat Camp, but...
That sounds a little more uptight. I like the Blomchill. It's relaxed.
Yeah. It sounds like a place you go to get
He likes to take the lead, so he wouldn't want my name first.
we may have struck a nerve.
Yeah. He's a director.
And you have a pet parrot named Ripley. Is that
is that
still up to date information?
Yeah.
It is.
Well, actually, when we got if it wasn't for me, Terry and Cassidy would live in a petting zoo. So I provide some sort of rational form of like where the animals must stop.
There's no monkey or pig.
Yeah, like, well, there will be a pig soon, but I've literally hit the brakes. There literally is a pig in the works.
You're going to be
joking. So what happened was she just developed this obsession with African gray parrots, and then she liked them so much that I actually talked her into getting one. For some reason, that was the one animal that she like hit the brakes on, but I was like, no, you should just get it because you love them. And then when we got it, it was female, and it was 8 years old, and we named it Ripley. And then we found out later that it was male. So then we were like, do we call it Ridley to, like, keep the lineage? And we were like, nah, fuck it. It'll just be Ripley. We'll keep it Ripley. So it's a male Ripley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want to confuse the parrot.
No.
Yeah.
Too much. Like, what am I?
I have an unrelated but it's a question about Chappie, but also kind of about Alien. There's a line in the film that's also in the trailer where Sigourney Weaver says, burn him to ash.
Yeah.
Is that a deliberate Alien nod? Because on the message boards, people are going,
it's
deliberate.
It's not, actually. Okay. But when she said it on set, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That often happens, though, when it, like, the words actually physically get said, you know? Yeah. Like, where it's like, maybe it was subconsciously in there. But no, it wasn't on purpose. She did another one as well, which I edited out of the movie, but it was in the movie until, like, within a few weeks of the final cut. Mm. And it's when Dev goes into the meeting with her and tries to pitch her on the idea of using one of the damaged chassis to upload the information. And in the movie, in the way it plays now, he preemptively understands what her response will be and leaves before she can get there, where in the older cut, she actually gets aggressive with him to stop him asking. Mm-hmm. And she says, she's like, no. And she's like, the way she said no, every time she said it on set was, because I've seen Aliens in like the, probably like the four digit territory. So when she said no, it was exactly like when they try to get her to go back to LV-426 and she's like, I said no and I mean no, you know. It was incredible. It was like a soundbite from Aliens. It was really weird.
And you went into a reverie for an hour. You're just standing there kind of replaying the movie.
Yeah. It was nuts.
There is kind of a xenomorph-shaped elephant in the room, which we've talked a little bit, but obviously you're making an Alien movie next, mm-hmm. Neil. I'm really fascinated by how that came about, because obviously you released concept art onto the internet. Presumably you've been having conversations with Fox about that before that. It wasn't just
No, it wasn't actually. Like, 2014 was a really weird year for me because, I usually know kind of quite decisively what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And in the process of post on Chappie, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And I had a bunch of different ideas for different films. But my favorite on like a gut instinct, like an artistic level, was Alien by a long way. But I had this like sort of inhibiting, you know, mental roadblock about just wanting to, you know, kind of work on my own stuff and not be held accountable really by whether it's the studio or by fans or whoever. I just want to be left alone to do my stuff. That's kind of a big deal to me. But what happened was, I mean, if you even go back 3 or 4 years, I've wanted to make a film in that genre, in that franchise, you know, for ages. And I had come up with an idea, and then when I met Sigourney on set, I assumed that she would never want to play Ripley again, rightly or wrongly. I just, for some reason, I had that in my head. And I also didn't know where you could go with her, given Alien 3 and 4. Mm. And so when I started speaking to her, and she was just, I just wanted to know about the process of making the first two films, because the first two are the ones that I care about, and like, you know, what she thought and everything else. Yeah, I started to realize that there actually was a whole, at least a film, if not more, that still contained Ripley, which I was really surprised by. And then when I went back to Vancouver and I had my weird year of 2014 of not being totally clear on what I wanted to make, I knew that my artistic compass kept driving me to Alien. And I spent, like, whenever I wasn't needed on Chappie, I spent a lot of hours working on Alien, you know, and to the point that I hired my own concept artists and, like, fleshed the entire movie out, basically. And then I still didn't know if I wanted to do it. And then I just, like, one night I sort of came to the conclusion that I was like, I mean, this is like an ongoing thing with us, like all the time, where, you know, I she's always like, no, you'll go back and do a film. And I'm always like, nah, I don't think this is the last film I'm going to do. Like, I genuinely believe it's the last film.
Sometimes I patronize. I'm like, okay, baby, that's good.
Yeah. We always need more hands in the restaurants.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But So I was so convinced that I just wasn't, I didn't even think I was going to make a norm, like any film, let alone a large studio film.
Yeah.
But I was like, it came from a place of like love, and it came from a place of me being a fan. And I was like, if I'm a fan, then other fans should see the stuff. Just at least here's one person's take on it, you know?
Mm.
And I just put out a bunch of art. But I still hadn't decided what I was going to do next. And then, so you see, Fox didn't know. And then after, like, I saw Sigourney again and her enthusiasm in it and me still not knowing what I was doing. It becomes kind of clear. The thing actually that made it really clear, tell them what happened. This was actually the binding thing for me because we have xenomorphs all over the house.
But he's humming and hawing, going back and forth. And finally, I said, look at what you make me drink my orange juice out of every morning. And I pulled out of the cupboard. We have these set of glasses that have like these brutal scenes from the movies. And yeah. I was like, you make your daughter drink out of these cups. This is a sign.
Yeah. And then that, no bullshit. Like that actually is what made me realize that it's like my whole, like there's a massive portion of my brain that's like taken up by the world of the xenomorph. And I was like, that's a valid point.
Yeah. We'll let you go in a second. Just one last question, Neil, about alien regeneration. That's the name of it, isn't it? Alien rebirth? Alien
He said he was going to try and pitch you some titles.
We're going to pitch you some titles.
Okay. He's already, you know, bought the website.
I'm curious. I'm super curious. Yeah. What would they be?
You've got an absolute poker face. It's amazing. Okay. Nick, throw something at him quickly. Alien, I don't know. What would it be?
This is actually a really... Okay, so I sent what I wanted as the title to Ridley, but it's kind of quite bold. And he was like, I really like that. So I'm going to test it. I don't think it's going to work though. But so I have my own idea, but it also sort of gives away too much if I say the title.
Okay.
But in the event that doesn't work, I'm kind of like dead in the water. So I actually am super curious, you know.
Honestly, the only title we really talked about was Alien 3. No, really, this is Alien 3. Not the other one.
Right.
This is the one. You should go and see this one.
Like,
it's a long
like
title.
No, really is in brackets. Yeah.
He's bought the URL already for that one. So,
guys, you really, it's embarrassing if you don't make it that title.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with Alien, whatever you end up calling it.
Cool, man.
Thank you so much. It's been
awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
They are very, very nice people. And if I'm ever in Vancouver, I'm going to stop by Terry Tatchell's tea room.
You just wanted to say that for the alliteration, didn't you?
I did. I thought I'd try and rescue you because this has been an absolute grammar car crash. I thought I'd stick in a bit of alliteration just to, you know, get the folks at home interested. Shall we have some movie news?
Ooh, let's.
So this is a tricky one because, you know, it's an audio medium.
Mm.
But nevertheless, the third and, I'm guessing, final trailer?
I hope final.
I think final.
Yeah.
Although, we'll get into this. There are a number of things that they haven't revealed yet. For Avengers Age of Ultron, after a spot of theatre where people had to retweet the hashtag Avengers Age of Ultron in order to unlock the trailer because, you know, Disney and Marvel were not going to show it to people until it was unlocked. There was no way that was planned as regardless. So anyway, trailer came out. I'm sure by now everyone listening to this has seen it. But what did we think? Hell's bells.
So excited.
It is exciting, isn't it?
I'm trying not to watch it too much because this is one of those films I don't want to have dissected to death before I go into it. That said, you know, offered a few more intriguing glimpses of the kind of stuff we can expect. It offered a few looks at something that has, for some unexplained reason, become catnip to Tumblr, which is the idea that Hawkeye owns a farm. Genuinely, this has become like the biggest thing in Avengers news.
What was he doing?
Hawkeye on a farm.
The downfall of S.H.I.E.L.D. He was rearing cattle. Easy now.
And there's a few scenes that appear to be in a farmhouse. And apparently people are going nuts because they think this is Hawkeye's farm. I'm not even kidding.
So hang on. Are you saying...
The most exciting thing.
No, hang on. Are you saying that in Avengers 2, Hawkeye buys the farm?
I'm not saying... I mean, he may have bought it already for all we know. But certainly there would appear to be a farm situation going on.
But this is amazing.
I know.
That's the thing that people are dwelling
that's
on?
That's the thing that people are dwelling on.
Hawkeye's property portfolio? That's what people are dwelling on? Okay, that's interesting. Well, I suppose he's got to do something. You know, I think it's interesting because, you know, Hawkeye went very Scottish there. Hawkeye! The new Hawkeye, Jeremy Renner, by his own admission, didn't get a lot to do in the first movie.
Mm.
And Downey keeps saying that he's very, very much front and centre in this one. He gets a lot more to do. But we haven't really got a glimpse of that. But if he is buying a farm and he's off showing people around properties and stuff, and his day job as an estate agent, because he's not a Shield agent anymore, is he?
Nobody
is,
really.
He's an estate agent.
Well, I'm not sure that follows, but interesting. Hmm. But yeah, I mean, honestly, listen, I thought I couldn't be more hyped about this film, and it turns out I could, and yeah. Now I am. So, hey.
The thing I'm glad about this trailer is that it actually shows this new stuff. The last trailer, the sort of second one, was just another version of the first one, which everyone loved. But this one actually has a lot of new information, a lot of tantalizing glimpses of things that may come to pass. We see, as I mentioned in the intro, Bruce Banner and Natasha Romanoff potentially getting hot and heavy, which leads, like, once again to all sorts of weird logistical questions.
Only for you, Chris.
No.
Well, for you and some other people.
No. Not only from, no.
Anyway, yeah. Moving on.
Anyway, yeah. Sorry, I'm genuinely, how does that work? But also, there's some interesting things. We get to see some real spectacle. We see there's a great shot of Captain America nearly sliding off a bridge, which is collapsing. Down below, you see a city, which it's very bizarre. I can't really tell what's going on there.
No.
But it looks fantastic. Hulk, there's more Hulk versus Hulkbuster. And there's
a great shot of them all sort of midair leaping through a forest. And it's like a comic book cover brought to life. And I have to say, that's one of the things that made me completely fall for the first Avengers. I finally felt like this is the kind of crazy, big scale, impossible stuff that I see in comics. And I'm finally seeing it on the big screen. And that shot gets that same feeling of this is a comic brought to life, but in a really, good and effective way.
I wonder if that's the opening shot, not the opening shot of the film, but I think that's the first time you see them.
The opening scene sort of thing.
The first scene in the movie, because it seems very, very slow motion. These are, this is it. This is the Avengers right here. Some really interesting little character beats. We still don't have really much of an idea of who Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch are. They're not really mentioned by names in the trailer. There's a lot more of Ultron in this one, a lot more of James Spader threatening people and talking about what he's going to do to people. It's nasty.
Awesome. I mean, bad. But,
yes, but bad. And I love the shot near the end where Thor yells, "Is that the best you can do?" And then Ultron unleashes what seems like hundreds of sub-Ultrons. And Steve Rogers goes, "Yeah, I had to ask." Which means that this still has humor despite the fact that,
High stakes.
They might all be about to die horribly. Yeah.
There's also obviously that very interesting final shot. Are we going to discuss that?
Yeah, let's discuss that.
So it's a sort of a metallic-y looking person with a red sort of skin and glowing sort of eyes. It's a little bit chappy, but it's more Vision.
Chapsticky.
No.
Okay.
Which is exciting. We still haven't had a full on good look at him. He's been in the background of a couple of things,
posters,
pieces
and stuff.
Of artwork and concept art. But yeah, hey, the Vision, man.
Paul Bettany as Vision, the artist formerly known as Jarvis. Very, very interested. That for me, it's really, really cool. We finally get to see part of his face, and obviously they're holding him back.
Yep.
But that also felt like that was one just for the fans, because I'm just thinking, if you're a casual observer of the MCU or just don't know anything about it at all, and you watch that trailer, you go, "What was that at the end? Who? What?" So I think that was like the appearance of Thanos at the end of the first Avengers. Mm. That was for us.
I am starting to think that Vision may be a kind of a bad guy that we're not expecting. Mm-hmm. I would like to put that out there as my minor bet. He could be affiliated with this AI construction or putting an AI into a body, and he could be the first thing that went bad. That's my bet. I think he's a form of a bad guy of a fashion, possibly at some point.
My feeling is that he will start as a bad guy.
Yes.
And he will end as a not bad guy.
That is your vision.
That is my vision. We shall see if it matches Joss Whedon's
I've got some news that isn't comic book related.
What? Get out.
And it's not the biggest news ever, but essentially there was that movie that we've been excited about by Steven M. Spielberg, which was known for a long time as Untitled Cold War Thriller, based on a Cold War story, as you may have guessed from Untitled Cold War Thriller, with some guy called Tom Hanks playing a
lawyer who called James Donovan, who was pushed into the Cold War during the 1960s when he had to negotiate for the release of a downed U2, insert jokes here about Bono, spy plane pilot by the name of Gary Powers after the airman was shot down over Russia. Mm-hmm. That's now being called, this is the news, Bridge of Spies, which is funny because of Bridge of Sighs, which is a bridge in Venice. But then there's another bridge, a lot like it in Oxford.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
So, you know, really, this means nothing. Bridge of Spies, it is the name of the film. It'll be coming out in October the 9th. And there are a lot of movies to look forward to this year. But Hanks, Spielberg, Cold War, a script rewritten by the Coen brothers. I'm interested. Let's watch it, please.
Sign me up for that one as well.
Is this part of the Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg cinematic universe?
It is indeed. It all connects together.
There was also other exciting news this week. Jeff Goldblum has been confirmed for the Independence Day sequel. May have been one of you said it on Twitter, I'm not quite sure, but do we need any other cast?
We don't need any other cast.
Just Jeff Goldblum reacting to the Return of the Aliens. Just him, on his own. One-man show, 2 hours, some explosions in the background, job done.
They should just set it in the old Vic. It's just Jeff Goldblum, like you say, on a chair, looking at the news reports, checking Twitter, going, Jesus! On his Mac, obviously.
Obviously. Diablo Cody is writing the next draft of the Barbie movie.
Well, obviously.
The Barbie movie.
I don't understand the thinking. Apparently it will see Barbie, who is, she comes in, she's like Mary Poppins, and she apparently, and I'm quoting here, uses her personal and professional skills to improve, end quote, the lives of some sad sack losers. What? And also, who do you get to play a woman who's 7.5 feet tall, 5 feet of which is leg? It sounds improbable and difficult. But, you know, if anyone's going to make Barbie bearable, it might be Diablo Cody, so good luck.
Did somebody say in the office, we need some barbed wit, and they got Diablo Cody in?
No, I think they said, this film's going to be diabolical.
Ah.
And I need some codeine to get through this film.
In the how did this get made, what are they thinking realms, there's also the director of Oblivion and Tron Legacy, whose name is...
Joseph Kaczynski.
That's the chestnut.
That's one.
He's being eyed up for a Gran Turismo movie.
Yes.
And again, just Barbie, that has like a 2% possibility of maybe working. Gran Turismo is like, you saw Need for Speed and that just didn't work. Like, what will Gran Turismo be about? I mean... But Need for Speed actually had possibly cops and robbers. Yeah. I mean, there's some kind of premise. Gran Turismo is just driving. Yeah. It's hitting your lines. It's taking corners well. It's braking at the right point. It's accelerating at the right point.
Well, it's also building your car, Ali. You know, you have to get your engine right.
Oh, I can't wait for that montage sequence.
You know, and all the camshafts and the... Yeah, I always lost it towards the end of Gran Turismo. I always get to a certain point and then you actually literally have to start balancing your engine. And I didn't understand any of that stuff. Like oversteering and understeering and camshafts and torque and all that nonsense. And I would just start smashing into the walls. So I hope maybe that's what he's going to do.
Maybe it should be Jeff Goldblum playing Gran Turismo for an hour and a half.
And suddenly we're back on board. Amazing.
Barbie being played with by Jeff Goldblum
for an hour and a half. You might want to rephrase that.
What, my grandma, what?
finally, one more news story that I was really interested in. Ridley Scott is planning a Flashman movie.
I beg your pardon?
Flashman is a very, very interesting character. He's originally the bully in Tom Brown's School Days, or one of the bullies in the old novel Tom Brown's School Days. And basically he was spun off in his own right by George MacDonald Fraser, and is basically has this complete crazy world and stories about him. He rubs shoulders with lots of fictional people. He inevitably behaves incredibly badly, like the whole like anti-hero to the max. So he's like, an awful, awful, awful human being.
So Riot Club spin-off.
Essentially not far off, but set in the 19th century.
He's a bounder.
He is a total bounder. He is a complete cad.
Like a Mordecai. Like an earlier Mordecai, is that what you're saying?
Except good, potentially. But, you know, he was in the Crimean War. He's very cowardly, but tends to come out of things looking like a hero, despite his best efforts. It's kind of intriguing. This could be quite good.
I can't help but hope but they do actually pronounce it. I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but in my head, whenever I knew of this character, I said it as Flashman. But in my head, I want them to call him Flashman, as if that's some kind of superhero.
Absolutely. And what would his power be? Don't answer that.
Running away.
Just running away?
Just running away.
Having just done something?
Running away and tripping up the guy behind him.
When he opens his coat,
that's very
difficult. Are really, really bright lights.
Hang on. You can't run away and trip up the person behind you.
He could.
It's logistically impossible.
He had very,
like
very
Bruce
long
Natasha.
Shoelaces.
Okay. That's intriguing. Paige and Tom Hiddleston. Paige and Tom Hiddleston.
That's what our entire readership said, certainly.
Yeah. Really? Well, you know, to be fair, they said that for most things. We said for most things, Paige and Tom Hiddleston, he hasn't arrived. Doesn't work.
He doesn't have a pager.
He doesn't have a pager.
That's our first mistake.
Damn it. Also in Independence Day 2 news, we should also mention that Liam Hemsworth has been confirmed as joining the cast, which is nice. Roland Emmerich confirmed that in a tweet. He had a hashtag Jeff Goldblum because Goldblum doesn't have a Twitter account, which is a massive shame. And Jesse Usher has joined the cast as Will Smith's son. So the son of Stephen Hillier, who many are now assuming will be the hero of this movie, because Will Smith has passed on coming back to Independence Day 2. And a decision, honestly, I thought that he might reconsider, given the way that its, you know, focus was clearly going from a box office point of view, which it did subsequently, hasn't done that well, sadly. But of course, he's now going to be doing Suicide Squad, isn't he, for David Ayer and Warner Brothers and DC, so perhaps he can't rejig his schedule even if he wanted to.
Possible. Finally, also, we should mention our spirit animal, Dan Stevens, is apparently going to be Beastly. He's in talks to play opposite Emma Watson in the new live-action version of Beauty and the Beast.
And who's playing Gaston?
Luke Evans.
Bloody Luke Evans, isn't it?
Oh.
Oh, hello, everybody.
No one fights like Luke.
Oh, be my guest. He does that song, doesn't he?
No.
No, okay.
No, he doesn't.
Well, he does now.
he actually has one of the best songs in it, Gaston. He's really
Is this going to be a musical version, or is this like the...
I don't know, probably not.
No.
Cinderella isn't.
None of them are there? Yeah, Jungle
the
Book's not.
Ones, no. Okay, so probably not a musical, which is kind of a shame because those Alan Menken songs are bloody awesome. But the script recently has seen work from Stephen Chbosky, who's the guy behind The Perks of Being a Wallflower, if I'm not mistaken, which of course also starred Emma Watson, and in which she was very good. So this is kind of shaping up rather interesting.
A ruddy, big, great, big, juicy film.
With Bill Condon directing.
Yes.
Yes.
And speaking of that, Mr. Holmes had a teaser coming out. That is the 93-year-old Sherlock Holmes movie. It's not that old a movie. He plays a 93-year-old Sherlock Holmes. That is, Ian McKellen does.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little teaser for it. It's coming out in June and not in December, which was its original period.
Uh-huh.
It's very much a teaser, seeing actually a slightly younger version of him in the Top Hat and Tails walking around London. But yes... Bill Condon's done a variety of stuff, hasn't he? I mean,
really
from Twilight
has.
To Gods and Monsters to Mr. Holmes to this, he's running the gamut, isn't he?
Racking along at a feral pace, isn't he? He absolutely is. What was I going to say? Yes, Gaston. Interesting. Calls to mind a Hugh Jackman story, which he's told. You know the story?
Yes, I know this story.
Hugh Jackman played Gaston on stage, I think in Broadway. I don't think it was over here. I think it was in Broadway. Because I don't think Beauty and the Beast ever came here.
It might have been in Sydney, actually.
All right, might have been a tour thing. Anyway, he played Gaston. And he tells a story about one day he went on the stage and he was desperate for a pee. And he was holding it in all the way through the show. And then he comes to his song, which is, of course, Helen, Gaston. And then, I didn't just Google that, Gaston. And so he needs to go to the toilet. And so the way he tells the story is that there's a big note near the end, high C, all that sort of stuff. And so he lets go with the note and lets go down below and just sits there luxuriating in the warmth of the Antipodean waters. Really
soaking,
you know,
into his woolen, you know, tights things. Not a good look.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's a tale. I wonder if Luke Evans will be doing that.
Let's hope
at any point.
Not.
Let's hope not. I have two more bits of news.
It's a big week for news.
Stop doing things, Hollywood. I'm really intrigued by this one. Genuinely intrigued and genuinely excited by this. The news that William Goldman is adapting Misery for the Broadway stage. William Goldman, of course, wrote Misery.
Isn't he making it a musical?
Misery.
Misery!
I'm going to cut your ankle off. Ankle, just your ankle. I'm very precise with an axe.
We should be clear, he wrote the screenplay, obviously.
He wrote the screenplay.
Stephen King novel.
He wrote the screenplay for Misery, but he's adapting it all into a Broadway play and playing the role of Paul Sheldon, the author who gets kidnapped by Annie Wilkes, his number one fan. He gets into a car crash, she kidnaps him and basically holds him prisoner and insists that he brings Misery Chastain back from the dead. It's Bruce Willis.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Jim Parsons.
No.
Okay.
That would have been amazing.
Jim Parsons, interestingly, will be playing God on stage this summer. So if you're lucky enough to be in New York, I'd look out for that one.
That's interesting because Sheldon does not believe in God.
And yet here we are.
It's almost like he's an actor playing different characters.
I would love to see Bruce Willis on this part. I would love to see it.
Yeah, me too.
I would genuinely, I would travel. I'm not going to because I don't have any money, but I would travel. I would try and get tickets for this because here's the thing about Bruce Willis. He is absolutely fantastic. He's an icon. He's a legend. He's a great actor. He's got tons of great films under his belt. But my God, he needs a career intervention because he. You look at his filmography. I'm just going to call up his filmography here on the old IMDb.
Are we going to include direct to DVD here?
Well, basically, that's all he's been doing for the last couple of years.
Video on no demand.
Absolutely. Because I'm seeing stuff constantly cropping up on VOD or going straight to Sky or whatever, and you're going, I had literally no idea. So Bruce Willis's last few films, okay?
I'm going to look over your shoulder. I want to see these as they come.
All right. So I'm gonna start. I'm going to go from 2012, okay? You can see when the sort of decline crept in. All right. So actually, no, I'm going to go for 2011. 2011, he's starting a film called Setup. Anyone?
Nope.
Anyone? Okay. Then he moves on to Catch 44.
Nope.
No? Okay. Then he starred in Stephen Frears' Lay of the Favourite. Good film. Got a cinematic release. Rebecca Hall, Catherine Zeta-Jones, all that. The Cold Light of Day. Again, got a kind
got
of cinematic.
Release, yeah.
Henry Cavill, Sigourney Weaver. Moonrise Kingdom. Good performance. Good director. Non-Bruce Willis-y. The Expendables 2. Then he did a film called Fire with Fire.
Nope.
No?
Nope.
Josh Duhamel, Rosario Dawson. But no. Then he did Looper. Great. Fantastic in that. Good Day to Die Hard. Less Said the Better. G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Ditto.
Red 2. Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. And then a film called The Prince with Jason Patric and John Cusack. Another man who needs a career intervention.
The Prince had my had three entries in my worst posters of 2014.
Oh, my word. And then his last film was a film called Vice with Thomas Jane, if we're talking about career interventions. And his upcoming projects include the likes of Magic City, Wake, and a film called Extraction, which sounds amazing. To me, he does need someone to just go, what are you doing, Bruce? What you need to do is you need to do a Broadway play. I'm really intrigued by this because he needs something, I think, to reinvigorate him and get the fires burning again.
Who should play Annie Wilkes?
Well, it is an actress called Elizabeth Marvel.
Oh, I don't know her.
Nor do I. But this makes it, I think, unofficially part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. it would be... It's interesting to me that they've gone big name, big name, big name. But, you know, and then Kathy Bates was unknown when she played Annie Wilkes the first time. Relatively unknown.
Oh, Elizabeth Marvel is in... I think I'm right in saying... Yeah, she's in House of Cards. She plays a very big role this season.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't know her name before.
Oh, is she the Secretary of State?
She is the Solicitor General.
Wow, she's
Say
great.
No more.
She's great.
Yeah. You're marveling at Elizabeth Marvel. good choice. I don't really know much more about that story yet in terms of when it's going to be running on Broadway and for how long for, but I think this is great casting, and I really do hope that it just gets the fires burning again under Mr. Willis's backside. And then, of course, the last thing is, and, you know, it's a tricky thing, this. I don't want to get maudlin or sad about it. I don't think we should be, because the man was a legend and we should be celebrating his life. Obviously, Leonard Nimoy died last week at the age of 83. And just, I think, after the podcast had gone out last week, so it was too late. We couldn't do anything on last week's podcast. But Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock himself, passed away. And, you know, it was interesting to me, not just watching the impact it had on us as well, the Empire Office, as geeks and there are certain Trekkies and whatnot in the office, but just everyone. This had a huge impact.
Yeah.
When Barack Obama makes a statement about your death, then it means that you touched people in a way that,
I mean, also, you know, Obama is a huge fan, has been known to throw the Vulcan salute to people, because he is, let's face it, a secret nerd. and had met Nimoy as well, which is pretty good. But yeah, no, he was pretty much universally beloved. He was one of those figures that sort of transcend a genre. I mean, even if you didn't particularly know Star Trek, you knew Spock. And you probably liked Spock, even if you didn't know Star Trek, because he's just such an iconic character who sort of, you know, even people who'd maybe only seen one episode, he lingers in the memory. You remember that guy. Mm. And the way I think that central relationship between McCoy, Kirk and Spock developed made us all feel like we were all part of it a little bit. If you look at the films, the reason that the Trek films that work as well as they do is because they focus on that relationship between those characters. And that goes for 2009 Star Trek as well as, you know, 2, 3, and 4. Mm-hmm. Wrath of Khan, the reason it still destroys me every single time I see it is that friendship. Mm-hmm. And it's an absolute thing of glory. And I think it, you know, it's down to, obviously, his efforts.
I would like to say that what I've liked about this is that there's no bad word to say about him, but he totally lived a 5-star, A-grade, great life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He died old after doing loads of great stuff. He earned money to support himself and give to other people. He was generous. He was kind. Everyone liked him. And what a great life.
Yeah.
He won. He did it.
Yeah. He was doing great stuff. Really fun stuff up until the end, whether it was, you know, a cameo in The Big Bang Theory. We talked about, you know, Sheldon Cooper a second ago. You know, he did a voice cameo. Have you seen that episode where he appears as his own action figure? Which is quite fun talking to Sheldon. That was cool. And then obviously the two cameos in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies and tons of stuff. And he did so many, you know, there's so many things outside Star Trek. Obviously he was a
director,
Three Men and a Baby and a couple of Star Trek films and The Good Mother and films like that. He was great in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Yeah. And yes,
Fringe as well.
Columbo. Bing, 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 bing. He made Columbo mad.
Wow.
Which never happens.
That's pretty impressive.
Never happens. Columbo slams the desk and says, I know you did it, and I'm going to get you, essentially. And, you know, Nimoy's all like, no, you're not. But then he makes a crucial mistake. Spoiler. Columbo gets him at the end.
Spoiler if you've never watched a Columbo episode.
He's a particularly nefarious doctor, and that one's called A Stitch in Crime.
Oh, I see what they did there.
Mm. he was brilliant. He was a legend. You're absolutely right, Ali. A life well-lived. Leonard Nimoy, who died last week. Okay, time now for our second guest. Julianne Moore had missed out on an Oscar on four previous occasions before this year's ceremony, but she was not to be denied for her astonishing turn in Still Alice as a woman suffering from early onset Alzheimer's. She came to London recently and spoke to Ali and Phil. Enjoy.
Julianne Moore, thank you so much for joining us on the Empire Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
To talk to us about Still Alice. Yeah. Now, I have a slightly curveball question to kick off with.
Okay.
It's something that's I've always wondered about watching movies.
Yeah.
You play Alice Howland, who's a mm-hmm. linguistics professor. She's one of those super high achieving people who's professionally and personally sorted at the beginning of the movie when we meet her.
Right.
And she's also very outdoorsy and she runs a lot.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
You do a lot of running in this movie.
Yeah.
I just wondered, do you have to warm up and
do
stretch?
Do I do my own running?
You don't have someone to do your running for you.
You know what? That's actually an interesting question, because actors will always tell you that we tend to not warm up. You just go into it and you're always like, ow. I actually did a movie where we all had to play volleyball, and a lot of the women who were there played volleyball like in college, and they were like, I don't know why I didn't warm up. I'm killing myself. I'm ruining my knees. So we all tend to not do it, you know.
Right.
But yeah.
But you pick up a strain or a niggle.
Yeah.
And then you can't run.
I know.
And then you have to get your
double in. That's yeah. right.
Mm. This is a film, I gather, that took 3.5 weeks to shoot.
Yeah,
is that
pretty
right?
Quick, yeah. It's all that we had money for.
Is that a record for you, 3.5 weeks?
It's about this. I think Kids Are All Right was close to that as well. I think that was also, I think it was 23 days. I think Kids Are All Right was also 23 days. That's pretty standard for $4 million movies. That's the extent of the days that you can get out of that amount of money, really.
And I was told that this, because this is a film about your character getting early onset Alzheimer's, this wasn't shot chronologically.
No,
so you were leaping around in presumably a very carefully mapped timeline of degeneration.
In this case, we tried to put the bulk of the work up front in the biggest location we had, which was the house. Mm-hmm. You know, so we started there. But that being said, that meant that the final scene of the movie was our ninth day. Wow. So we had to do kind of the initial stuff early on and then get to the very, very end on the... And I remember Chris and I looked at each other on the ninth day and we're like, oh my gosh, we hadn't done any of the beach things or anything like that. So it was tricky, you know, trickier than most because I was dealing with something, you know, with a real decline. Mm-hmm. And I needed to kind of map that out. But that's why I did... That's one of the reasons I did the amount of research that I did, because I always wanted to know exactly where I was and what I would be doing at each point.
On that note, I'm sure when you were approached with this, you must have read the script and thought, I really want to be a part of this.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Was the immediate reaction yes, and then I'm going to have to do 4 months of research?
The immediate reaction was yes, you know, And actually, the first thing I said to the guys is they're never going to get the money. Because I said to them, I was like, when do you want to shoot this? And they were like, well, about, you know, a year from now, the following September or whatever. And I said, yeah, call me when you have it because you're never going to get the money for this. And I really did think it would be a couple of years. And they did surprise me. And then once it happened, they were like, okay, we're ready to go. And I was like, oh, gosh, I've got to do, you know, if we're going to do this, I really do need to do the work because I don't know anything about this. So it was a matter of about 4 months of research before I felt comfortable.
And when you were on board and things were happening, at what point did you realize you're going to have such an amazing supporting cast?
Oh, we were so lucky. Well, it just came together in the oddest way because we were talking about, you know, first we talked about the guy who was going to play a husband, and they said, what are your ideas? I said, well, I thought of Alec Baldwin. I said, but he's never going to do this. And Alec's a friend of mine, and we just from 30 Rock. And every time I offered him something, you know, I'd say, hey, I got the script. You want to do this? He'd be like, no, no. It was always a comedy. He's like, no, 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 no. And then I was like, well, I have this. Do you have a drama? I said, I have this little movie, but the part's too small. I don't think you want to do it. And he said, send it anyway. And then he said, yes. And I was convinced he would drop out. I couldn't believe it. And he was in. And then the guys called me and said that because we just had the most amazing meeting with Kristen Stewart. I'm like, she's never going to do this. She's too busy. And then she said yes. And, you know, then we had Kate and Hunter and Steve Kunkin and amazing people. So it was really surprising that it came together.
There's one really beautiful moment in the movie mm-hmm. that stood out for me when I was watching it when she loves to go for ice cream.
Yeah.
What flavor was the ice cream? You know, it was Coke.
I had regular or something with coconut and blueberries.
Is that your own personal taste?
Yeah, it is.
Is it? Oh, really?
Amazing. They were like, you're gonna have to eat this in the scene. What do you want to order? I said, this is what I eat.
Yeah, because you have to just eat.
Yeah.
Eat, you know, take and take.
Exactly.
But you I don't want to give too much away about mm-hmm. the context, but you rest your head on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's heartbreaking.
One of the things that I saw was that people, as they became more declined, were very attached to the people that they loved and that cared for them. And I kind of wanted you to see that in that scene that she's ordering the ice cream and they're in that place and she starts to feel uncomfortable because she's with people she doesn't know. And she doesn't want to look at the guy that she's ordering from because she doesn't know him. So she does all her ordering to her husband, like looks in his eyes and then kind of sidles up and like a little kid would, you know. So she feels safe with him, safe and loved. And I kind of wanted to demonstrate that there.
He's kind of updated from the book, the original book, which was about a decade ago. And this has your iPhones and your apps and your Skype and all that sort of thing. How good are you personally with all the modern accoutrement? Would you be able to find the folders on your desktop and find all the notes and the stuff?
I'm not too bad. I'm all right. I mean, I still have to ask my children like how to do. I'll be like, wait a minute, what is that function? How'd you do that? You know, but I'm a lot better than I was years ago.
Is it true you're a Facebook lurker?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I haven't lurked in a while, but what's Facebook for if not
lurking.
To lurk, right? Yeah.
Twitter?
I tweet. But I don't do Instagram. I follow my kids on Instagram and a couple of my girlfriends and stuff. But I do like Twitter and I tweet occasionally and I like it as a news source too. And I follow some comedians and stuff, you know. So it's great. It's great because when you don't have anything else but your phone, you've got plenty to read.
I gather you have known Kristen since she was 12.
Yes.
What's the story behind you knowing for that long?
Kristen did a movie with my husband. He cast her in a movie called Catch That Kid. And he said, you know, there's this actress, this young girl that I really, really want to hire for this. And he ended up, you know, using her in the movie, and would come home every day and say, this girl is extraordinary. She's the real deal. She's going to be a big star. And he wasn't wrong. Mm-hmm. And she's not any different than she was when she was 12. The same personality, the same desire to do really, really good work, you know, the same authentic self, you know, she's just lovely. I adore her.
I have a question that's vaguely related to Kristen, because she plays an actress, an aspiring actress, and she has to be an actress within the context of the film, which you have done, obviously, in Boogie Nights as well.
Right.
Paul Thomas Anderson has said that you were the best bad actress on the film. And I just wondered how proud you were of that accolade.
I'm pretty proud of it. I'm pretty proud of it.
That's not necessarily an easy thing to do, is it?
I actually remember that day because pretty much the whole cast was present, because we had to do, you know, we had to do that big scene. And everybody laughed, which really, really made me happy, you know, because you want to make people, you know, obviously doing stuff like that, you want to make people laugh. And
do you remember any of the dialogue at all?
I don't come up with the rent, I'm going to lose my apartment. My landlord is a real jerk, I think was the one.
I think that was it. Yeah, there was some financial issues.
My landlord is a real jerk. That was my favorite.
You get the feeling that everyone in the crew is just trying not to.
To laugh.
To laugh.
Yeah, which was great. Like I said, I was really happy that they thought it was funny.
I've been asking a lot of people this recently, and I've been getting pretty odd results, but in a good way.
Oh, okay.
What is the strangest directorial note you've ever been given? Yeah, most obscure, when you've been told to act purple or something like that.
Oh my God, I'm trying to think. I mean, I think I automatically thought of like the best one. Can I say the best? It was when a guy said, I was doing Hamlet. I was 28 years old and I was at the Guthrie Theater and I was playing Ophelia in Hamlet, and I had to do the mad scene, you know, which is really scary. So scary and so big, and I had to sing all these songs and do everything. And he looked at me and he said, sorrow. And that's all he said. Oh. And I was so blown away. And I think I've never forgotten it, because, you know, so often people talk about, you know, playing crazy, or, you know, what's, you know, what is the nature for illness and all this kind of thing. But it's sorrow. It's incredible grief. And he was able to kind of winnow it down to that one word.
You're actually a UK citizen.
I am.
You're one of the Queen's.
I am one of the Queen's subjects. That's
right.
That's right.
Being back in the UK here, talking to us now, is there any way that you're thinking back to Children of Men? Is that in any way in your mind?
I wasn't, but now that you brought it up,
news. Yeah. Great news. Because I think I honestly can't think of a person I know that doesn't love that film.
I love that film.
Do people approach you a lot in the street? If they see you, do fans talk to you about that film a lot?
People do talk about that. I mean, they talk about lots of other things, but that is one of the movies that comes up. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. You know, Alfonso Cuarón is a great filmmaker, and Clive was so, so very good. And it was really an interesting process, you know, and a great surprise, I think, what happens in the movie. But I loved it. I really, really loved it.
You must have watched Gravity and gone, well, this is different.
You know, Alfonso's work is always different. Mm. It's always, that's one of the things that makes him a really compelling filmmaker, is that he's always going to tell incredibly unique and big stories, you know, very big stories.
So as a British citizen, as a Brit, are you looking for a football team to support?
God, should I just say Manchester United?
No,
Chelsea.
Ideally not.
Chelsea?
Oscars.
That's the only two I know.
Something.
Liverpool?
Yes. Spurs. Spurs are good. Try them. The Oscars are coming up, and I know you've been asked to death about it, but I have to ask you about, because you've been one of the people who's been nominated twice in the same year.
Yeah,
which is amazing and unusual.
Great. Yeah, I lost though, but it's all right. You know,
yeah, I wasn't going to mention that. You brought it up. Did you write two speeches?
No, I don't write any speeches.
So you're not going to write a speech for.
Bad luck, man.
Is it bad luck?
I think it's bad juju. Bad juju. Thank you for saying juju. That's one of my favorite things to say.
It's a good word.
Bad juju.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be nerve-wracking to sort of stand up there, you know, not to jinx anything, but if you were to stand up there, just.
I got just one day at a time.
Fair enough.
And finally, we are in London. Bring you back to the UK.
Are we
are a little bit.
Okay.
Where do you like to go in London?
Where I thought I was.
Yeah, thank God. where do you like to go in London if you have a free 2 hours? Where would you go?
Oh gosh, I mean, I love London. I like to go. You know, I like to walk around Notting Hill and Bayswater. I like to go. You know, I like to be in Mayfair, go shopping. I like to go to Hyde Park. I like to go to the you know, I used to take my kids to the Princess Diana playground, you know, I mean, that kind of stuff, you know, I mean, it's all, I love the Portobello Road. I mean, it's, there's so many great things here, you know, so I enjoy it.
Well, this is how you pass the citizenship test, isn't it? You
know, I had to name all my favorite places. Yeah. That's right.
Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's start off the review section with Still Alice then. Still Ali.
So yeah, Still Alice, a film that has Oscar written all over it, because it's just got one of those amazing performances right at its heart. It centres on this Alice character, who is a linguistics professor, who lives with her husband, played by Alec Baldwin, who is great to see in a non-comedic role. It's good to see Alec Baldwin just being a good supporting actor, buddying up here with her friend from 30 Rock. That's how he got involved with the project. They were looking for somebody who could we get to be her husband, and she said, oh, well, I know this guy called Alec Baldwin, and he said, yeah, sure, I'd love to do it, as long as it's not me goofing about doing comedy. And this one definitely isn't that. It's about early onset Alzheimer's disease, and you have somebody who is this linguistics professor who is all about the words, a bit like myself today, who you see early on in the film gradually showing signs, very slight signs like pauses and beats that are a little bit worrying, and then you see it kind of tumble. It happens quite quickly, but she, in a course of just like 30 days shooting, out of sequence, nails these different stages. And time kind of passes here and there quite quickly, but it is a very, very strong performance, and the film is the performance. There are other characters here, of course. I mentioned Alec Baldwin. There's also Kristen Stewart, who plays her youngest daughter, who's a bit of a theatrical, I just want to try things type LA person. And then she's got other children, one of which is Kate Bosworth. So there's a lovely supporting cast around her, but it is the Julianne Moore show just being brilliant scene to scene. At times I felt it was a bit, because it's jumping through time, I went, wow, that's a really drastic change, but I don't know Alzheimer's, it's not something I'm familiar with, and this is almost like a learning process for the audience to discover, wow, this is what it's really like. And it's about going to the doctors and coping with it as a family, and it doesn't make you laugh, shall I say, but it isn't a crushing misery type film. There is light to it. Everyone in it is fantastic. She is particularly good. There are sweet moments. There are sad moments. It's got a lot going for it. The trouble is, it's just got 93 minutes to do it, and it seems at times a little light. And maybe I actually wanted a bit more of the brutal stuff of this is what it's actually like and the really tough stuff. And I don't want to give too much away, but it doesn't go truly into the heart of darkness here. Directed by Richard Glatzer and Wash Westmoreland. Richard Glatzer is actually, he actually suffers from a degenerative disease, ALS. And he whilst on set, was communicating via an iPad. He can't move very well. He now lives at home, basically through the internet. And so it's a real kind of mirroring of the director and a degenerative disease. A very admirable film. I personally think that our 5-star rating of this film, we've given it 5 stars, would be a little bit too much for me in terms of how good it really is. But no one will regret seeing this film. It is a at times quite heartwarming study of a interesting character and how this very, very intelligent woman copes with the loss of her faculties.
I believe... I should know this for sure, but I believe that 5 stars in Empire at the moment means must see. So
in the guide.
Yes, that's our rating. So must see, you must see this film for the performance.
Yes, definitely. And yeah, it's going to be one of those films that's going to be in small cinemas, select cinemas across the country.
So seek it out. But
find it, Google it, see what's going on close to you.
Yeah, I don't think we're saying it's one of the best films of the year.
No.
But nevertheless, the performance is very, very good.
She's amazing.
She is truly amazing.
5 stars in for Still Alice. Let's move on now to Chappie. The embargo has finally lifted on Neil Blomkamp and Terry Tatchell's Chappie. We couldn't really talk about it at all. I don't even think I could reveal that I'd seen it until yesterday. I couldn't even tell my wife. What's that about?
Outrageous.
I know. We had nothing to talk about. What did you see last week? Nothing. Can't tell you. She thinks I'm having an affair.
This is terrible. Chappie ruining lives. And yet, it's not a bad film.
Oh, let's talk about the film. Let's do that.
No, I want to talk about your marriage.
Let's do that. Yeah. Okay. Helen. Yeah.
So this is the new one from Neil Blomkamp and, as you said, Terry Tatchell. It's the set in a sort of very, very near future. 2016 is mentioned at one point, but I think it might be like 2016, 2017. It's very, very close to now. And the idea is that crime has gotten so bad, in particular in Johannesburg, where it's set, that the police have adopted robot policemen, which are, you know, pre-programmed, they're able to respond to stimuli and orders. They're not true artificial intelligences, though. And their designer, who's played by Dev Patel, wishes to develop true artificial intelligence and borrows one of these, a decommissioned robot, a damaged robot, in order to test out his new program for artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. As he does so, unfortunately for him, he is carjacked by by some baddens, by some armed robbers, who are played by a South African rap / rave collective, whose name I cannot
the Antfort.
The Antfort, yes. Thank you.
Ali is South African, of South African origin. Is that right?
Yes, these people are notoriously bonkers. I don't know how they got them onto set. They are insane.
I've heard rumors that they had slight problems with them on set, but the performances on film are actually pretty effective. Ninja.
I don't agree.
Okay,
with that,
well, we'll come back to that in a minute. Ninja, the sort of daddy, is more violent and more frankly unhinged. And then the mother figure, Yolinda, is slightly more caring and maternal towards Yolandi, sorry. And the mother figure, Yolandi, is more sort of caring and maternal towards what is essentially a newborn intelligence, a very, very big intelligence, but a newborn one. So Chappie is essentially raised by these people, with Dev Patel trying to kind of get his creation back.
So he's carjacked, but then he becomes buddies with his carjackers.
He doesn't have the choice, really. It's a slightly complicated situation. But yeah, he manages to get away from them, but keeps going back because they have Chappie. Essentially, but meanwhile,
can't call the cops because he's compromised himself as well
by stealing Chappie in the first place. And then you have Hugh Jackman's character, Vincent Moore, who is ex-military and has his rival robots that he wants to get on the street. Now, these are essentially ED-209, like pretty much exactly, but it's called Moose. But it's controlled by a neural interface with a human being. So it's a kind of, it's already setting up a man versus machine intelligence sort of an issue, and he's kind of investigating what Dev Patel's character is up to. Chappie himself, I thought, was quite a charming character in that newborn, innocent, discovering life way that, you know, all such characters I think are pretty charming on film. The robot design and execution in terms of VFX is astonishing. You never for a second doubt that he has weight and he has presence. And, you know, that's partly obviously down to Charlton Copley, but also down to the effects guys. Incredible, incredible work by them. I think the problem for me is, and I don't want to get into spoilers, and that's really frustrating because most of my problems are spoilers, but it feels like this film sets up this titanic sort of philosophical clash and doesn't really get into that. And it also feels like it's just getting going as it finishes. Like, that's what I want to see. That's the story that I want to see. And all this gangster stuff that happens during the film, I could have done without, really. So it was effective to me in getting me thinking about stuff that would happen down the line from this, but it wasn't effective in telling its own story from soup to nuts. That was my biggest issue with it, I think. And I think if you developed the Dev Patel versus Hugh Jackman clash a bit more, you just needed one or two more scenes of them actually talking to each other, then I feel like it would have been a much more effective film, because what you have in the end is that these two are both equally important, and you didn't really get that from the film that we see on screen. And I think that would have been magnificent. I think if they'd focused on that and focused on those issues, I think it would have been a much more powerful film. As it is, in the same way that RoboCop last year slightly disappointed us, this felt a little bit disappointing. It's better than that, but it's still not all it could have been.
Oh yeah, I thought the RoboCop remake was absolutely terrible, one of the worst films of last year by a country mile. Yeah, this is interesting. I feel that the film is a little bit of a muddle, but I also feel that there's a lot of great things in it, and it's always nice to see a director really taking risks and swinging for the fences. And I said the same thing about Matthew Vaughn a few weeks ago with Kingsman. You know, and even if that swing doesn't always come off, it's nice to see directors in the mainstream taking chances and trying to put things on this big screen that we've never seen before. I wasn't a big fan of The Antwort. Am I getting that right?
The Antwort!
Okay.
in the film, I thought that their performances were slightly weak, but also I thought the characters themselves were, especially Ninja. It's a really interesting idea that it is them playing themselves, falling on hard times in a couple of years' time when they turn to crime. But I thought Ninja especially was a character that it's really tough to spend time with. There's absolutely nothing wrong in the film of the character being unlikable or unrelatable, but I think you have to be interesting, at least, in order to effectively become one of the heroes of the film, and he doesn't earn that at all, I think. And Chappie himself, I found, was quite irritating. Absolutely, really irritating. I thought initially it was almost like an actor's workshop, actor playing child 101 with all the, you know, his chittery little childlike movements. As he becomes more assured, the character becomes funnier. But for me, it doesn't have the emotional impact of Ficus from District 9. Whose emotional journey, whose journey is very moving and very impactful. I don't think Chappie's is necessarily. For me, the standout in this movie is not Sigourney Weaver, poor Sigourney Weaver, who is saddled with a pretty thankless role, which has led to an Alien movie, so we should be thankful for that. But Hugh Jackman, who's great fun.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's ever met Sam, our former colleague Sam Toy, who is an angry Australian who wore shorts with a beard. Sam, if you listen to this, mate, I think he's captured you. Yeah, absolutely, right down to, you know, all the swearing and killing people. It's amazing.
Do you know what? He's really, really good at being scary and bad. This has given me a lot of hope for Hook. Like, Hugh Jackman, bad guy, was really fascinating. I know he's played a few before, but this one I thought was on another level. The mullet alone was terrifying. But the only thing that got me about his character is his creation seemed perfect for the military.
Yes.
And there he is trying to sell it to the police. It's like, go to the army. They will buy it in a hot second. Why are you trying to sell it to the police? Jeez.
But, for all the muddle and for the fact that, you know, some of the characters are hard to spend time with, there's some great things in this. Jackman's great fun. There's a couple of great action sequences. There's a really funny bit where Ninja and his sidekick America are teaching Chappie how to hijack cars, and that's
funny. Really funny, that scene.
This film's getting a kicking at the moment. I kind of feel it's unwarranted a little bit. For me, it's better and more enjoyable than Elysium. But in terms of, is Blomkamp the real deal we thought he was with District 9, or was that a one-off? I kind of feel we're still on the fence a little bit with that one. Mm. And I think Alien might settle that, whatever he does with the Alien franchise. But it's interesting. He said himself he doesn't really know if he wants to be a director.
Well, both of those films, District 9 even, as well, like this one, I was always more interested in what happened afterwards than I was in a lot of what I'd seen on screen. And I feel like he might have an issue with endings. Maybe it's just me, I don't know. But
possibly, yeah. Possibly. I kind of know what you mean. Yeah. This is interesting because, like District 9, it starts off in a sort of COD documentary, COD newsreel format. You get Anderson Cooper in this one.
Yeah.
So they've made a bit of a step up. Which kind of establishes the world, establishes the environment, and then just kind of drops it. He drops it stylistically and turns it into a straight narrative, which is kind of interesting, I guess.
Also gorgeously shot. I actually want to say that it's beautifully, beautifully filmed, and there's some stunning slow mo of smoke and flame that is just gorgeous. So
yeah, absolutely. But we have given Chappie 3 stars. So that is a recommendation. Do go and see it. There's a lot of good stuff in there. A lot of things that deserve to be seen on the big screen. Next up is Hyena, which is a searing cop drama from Gerard Johnson, which stars Peter Ferdinando as effectively Bad Lieutenant. It's a very much a British version of Bad Lieutenant. This is a gut punch of a movie. I think I'm the only person in the room who's seen this one. Do go seek it out if you can. It's got fantastic performances. You will stumble out afterwards into the sunshine or into the night, the London night if you're in London. And, you'll just want to have a sit down and a nice cup of tea, because this is this movie puts you through the ringer. It's fantastically acted. Peter Ferdinando, if you don't know who he is, he was in Gerard Johnson's Tony, which came out a few years ago, about a very particular serial killer. He was also in Ben Wheatley's A Field in England. He'll next be seen in Ben Wheatley's High Rise. He was the bad guy in Ben Wheatley's Peter Capaldi episode of Doctor Who, the guy, the robot with the half a face. Do you remember that guy?
No.
No, mm-hmm. Helen remembers him.
Of course, too.
Yeah,
So he's very, very, very good. And he's basically playing a cop who has gone to seed in a major, major way in this one. And his corruption finally begins to catch up with him in this movie and leads him into down a series of increasingly dark decisions. And one of the most interesting endings I've seen for a while. But it's fantastically acted as well by people like Stephen Graham's in this. He's great. Richard Dormer of Our Shores, Helen, is fantastic in this one as well. Miana Buring's great as well. And it's about whether this guy has a soul. And it feels a bit like Bad Lieutenant in the Well as well, and that there's someone there. There's like a figurehead that he sees who could potentially offer a shot at redemption. Does he take it? It's really, really interesting, but it's not a fun ride. But 4 stars for Hyena. Last but not least is Unfinished Business, a comedy in which Vince Vaughn and pals go to Berlin on a business trip and shit happens. They go to a gay bar and they have encounters with glory holes, and they, you know, and Tom Wilkinson plays an old man who wants to have sex and swears a lot, and that's the joke. And Dave Franco plays one of the most misjudged characters I've seen in the big screen for a long, long time. But what it is this really kind of weird hybrid film where there's actually this kind of quite interesting, not amazing, but quite interesting story about this decent guy played by Vince Vaughn who wants to do right by his business and wants to do right by his wife back in America. Pretty thankless role for the wife, but nevertheless it's all focused on Vince Vaughn. He's got kids, one of whom's being bullied at school. That's kind of quite interesting, not compelling by any means, but and then every now and again remembers that it's got to be a raucous R-rated lads comedy in this post-hangover world, and so people start getting their you know, willies out, and there's lots of nudity and drinking and vomiting and whatnot, and the two don't really mix. And for me it's a bit of a shame because this is from Ali, you and I saw Delivery Man last year, and it's not a great film by any stretch of the imagination, but it's like quite charming.
It sounds like the opposite of what this film is.
Absolutely. It seems baffling to me that Ken Scott, the director of that, and Vince Vaughn would go from that to this, which is not sweet, not charming in any way, and wastes all these brilliant actors, including
Sienna Miller.
Sienna Miller's in this, is his ball-busting nemesis, and she's quite fun, and Nick Frost turns up, and he's quite fun, and poor Tom Wilkinson, gets absolutely nothing to do, and Dave Franco is absolutely terrible in this movie. It's just a shame because you can see what it could have been had every scene been rewritten. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by, holy cow, Jim Parsons. Just we talked about him on the podcast and we made him appear.
Bazinga.
It's amazing. Bazinga. He's going to be here to talk about the new DreamWorks animation movie Home, and Gemma Arterton. We'll be dropping by as well to talk about The Voices. So that's a good pod, isn't it?
Yeah, I just saw The Voices last night. Whoa.
Good?
Whoa.
Okay.
So weird, but maybe good?
Yes.
We'll discuss it.
Okay, we'll talk about it next week. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Grammar King. I'm going to call you the Grammar King from now on. That's
no,
your
please,
thing.
Please don't.
Your introductions.
How can I... Okay, have a goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to finish my research into Bruce Natasha's sex life. That's Bruce Forsyth and Tasha Kaplinsky, of course. No, it isn't. It isn't. I cannot stress that enough.
Who's the Hulk in that one?
That's my secret, Cap.
Stop it.
A good game. What a lovely Chitauri army. So much better than last week's. Right, anyway, I'm off.
Bye.